I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
If it's a kidnapping, I'd have a ransom note by now, says private investigator Ernest Rizzo about the 1977 disappearance of Candy heiress Helen Voorhees Brock. But despite his confidence that she's still alive, no one has seen her. And as the days turn into months, turn into years, it becomes more and more clear just how wrong Ernest Rizzo is about what happened to Helen. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, normally I would ask you how you're doing, but we do not have time for chit-chat today.
So I'll keep my mouth shut.
We'll see.
We'll see.
Yes, so Good. We're shining light on Helen Brock, who has been missing since 1977. And this story is a lot, which is not necessarily surprising to me. But this is about Helen, of course, but it's also about a candy fortune, shady detectives, questionable housemen, insurance fraud, horses, animal welfare groups. Like, we just have a lot of ground to cover. And there are a lot of names that I mention in this episode.
Okay, this is quite a mix of things we're talking about here.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this might not be surprising because this does tie into our episode number 49, which also I was looking back at, and I also said, this episode is a journey.
Yeah.
And that was, we mentioned Helen Brock briefly in that episode. I encourage everyone to check it out to kind of get a broader understanding of what's going on, but you don't need to understand what's happening here. Before we get into all of that and what happened to Helen, I want everyone to fall at least a little bit in love with Helen Brock. Do you know that quote? Have you seen that quote? It's like a video of Cher, and she's talking about her mom, and Cher's mom says, "You need to marry a rich man." And Cher says, "Mom, I am a rich man."
No.
No, it's great.
I'm going to have to look it up.
Yeah, that is not Helen.
No. She's not a rich man.
She had aspirations of marrying a rich man. She's often called the candy heiress or the candy lady. because she was married to Frank Brock Sr., one of the founders of Brock Candy, but that doesn't really say much about Helen herself. So Helen was born on 11-11-11. Yeah, to Walter and Daisy Voorhees in rural Ohio. Her father worked on the railroads, and when he was old enough, her younger brother Charles did as well. She married her high school sweetheart, Harlan, and the marriage ended pretty quickly. Helen was divorced by the time she was 21, largely because Harlan cheated on her. She'd later tell a friend that she felt she wasn't a very sexy person, and this is what led to her first marriage ending. To support herself after her divorce, she took a series of jobs like selling tickets for Toronto Steubenville Interurban, which to my understanding is like a localized passenger trains, doing accounting work at Sayo Pottery. But eventually she gets what will be kind of a life-changing job for her, and that's selling tickets at the Starlight Ballroom near Columbus, Ohio. And that's because people would travel from all over to go to the Starlight. And so she would see these like cars coming in and the women getting out in furs and jewelry. And that really wasn't part of her life back home. And she discovered she really wanted.
I was going to ask.
Yeah. Like it was not in her small town, Ohio. Like
she was dazzled though.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so she was like, I'm out of here. She takes off to Florida and gets a job. And she's working at the Indian Creek Country Club in Miami. So this has to be a huge change from her to go from rural Ohio to Miami. And she's a hat check girl and also a hostess.
Just the hats?
Just the hats, yeah. Yeah.
No coats here.
Like, I wonder if there's like a separate like coat check person.
That's what I'm wondering.
Just, like, don't need it in Miami.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe.
I don't know. I did not look up
what that means.
The coat check industry in Miami. Now, like, I am guessing that despite Helen not feeling like a particularly sexy woman, she was hit on a lot. And I say this because she actually is a very striking woman. She had like red hair, which had, of course, garnered her the nickname Carrot Top, like every other redhead in existence. And, you know, it was quite long. Also, she's like 5'10", right?
So she's not easily overlooked.
No, no. And in 1949, one of the men she caught the eye of was Frank Brock Sr. Frank, to give everyone some knowledge of who this guy is, his father, Emil, and his brother, Edwin, the three of them started a small candy shop back in 1904. And Frank had gotten his start selling sauerkraut candies in theaters in Chicago.
Did you just say the wrong thing?
No.
You said sauerkraut candies.
I did.
Did you? Please tell me you researched what that meant.
I just really didn't want to. That feels like a very niche flavor of candy. Not to judge early 1900s people on their taste.
No, I'm judging them.
What if there are people listening now who appreciate sauerkraut candies?
Well, I'm sorry if I'm hurting your feelings, sauerkraut candy lovers, but I just haven't tasted it yet, so.
Well, there are a myriad of opportunities.
Okay, I'm going to make a note to check what that is later.
Okay. Now, their business grew exponentially, and by 1923, they had four factories, and they were having to build more. So we're talking a fortune in candy.
In sauerkraut candy.
Well, not just sauerkraut candy. They had expanded beyond sauerkraut.
Like, I'm just like living a normal life trying to make ends meet during normal jobs that don't involve sauerkraut candy.
Yeah.
Yet they have a fortune.
Yeah.
It feels unfair.
It does. Right. Yeah. So he's living his life and Helen meets Frank. And it sounds like he's immediately enamored with her. There's just one problem. His second wife, June, is with him when they meet Helen.
What do you mean with him?
Like she's just married? There.
Oh, she's in the room.
Yes.
He's checking out the tall redhead.
Absolutely.
While his wife is right there.
Yeah. And this, like, his friend will go on to say, like, Douglas Stevens, who's his friend and colleague, says, Frank had a roving eye and lots of money. So no one is really surprised by this. So obviously being married didn't stop him from pursuing Helen.
I feel sad for his wife.
Yeah, and it didn't stop Helen from meeting Frank either, because the two start having an affair. They're meeting up in hotels in Miami and Pittsburgh and Chicago, and they carry on for, like, at least a year.
Poor June.
Yeah. So June finds out.
Obviously, at some point that has to happen, right?
Yeah. And she files for divorce. She alleges extreme and repeated cruelty towards her.
Good for her.
And in November 1950, this divorce is granted, and she's given, like, $400,000 in the divorce. And soon after, Frank goes, he asks both, you know, Helen's father and Helen's brother for her hand in marriage. So, from divorce to marriage happens pretty quickly. Are you judging?
I'm a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Our listeners can't see your face, but it's a judgy face.
It's a little judgy face. I'm glad that June got something, but, like, let's divorce and then start a new relationship.
Like, step one.
Step one, step divorce. One. Step right. two, new relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So by 1951, Frank and Helen, they get married at one of Frank's properties in Glenview, Illinois, which ends up being their primary home. And, like, look, Frank's been around the block, so to speak. He's 20 years older than Helen. His first wife, because June is his second, his first wife alleged he'd abused her. He's obviously cheated on his second wife, but by all accounts, he adored Helen. Apparently, during his first board meeting after their marriage, he went in and he changed the packaging of Brock's candies to include the color pink because it was Helen's favorite.
Well, that's kind of nice, I guess. I mean, I don't really think he's a great person, but I won't stop buying their candies.
If they're sauerkraut.
Yeah, I don't know. I would try it because I love both candy and sauerkraut.
Okay.
So, update on the sauerkraut candy. There is no sauerkraut in it, and it's not sauerkraut flavored. It's just a coconut candy that's cut in the same way that cabbage is.
Well, I'm glad we looked this up because I knew you were going to be thinking about this right. The rest of the episode.
So right? I would, in fact, eat this candy.
Okay.
So, yeah, it makes sense now. Sorry about everything I just said about sauerkraut candy.
Okay. Now, back to Helen.
Back to Helen.
For the rest of their marriage, the two seem to live, like, a pretty quiet life. Like, though large, the Glenview house just really isn't ostentatious. They did own quite a few other properties, including 6 untilled farms, meaning they were not actively
being tilled.
Farmed, yes. In Illinois and Ohio, they would summer in Glenview, winter in Florida. They took frequent trips to New York City. They'd visit Helen's family, and Frank would walk around town with, like, pockets full of candy for
children. Are you trying to convince me to like this guy?
I don't know. I feel like he entered his, like, old man era, so, like, the pockets full of candy. He'd also go up to, like, Holtrap's Market near Tappan Lake, and he'd go into the, like, store and go to the Brock's candy display, and he'd declare, "Good stuff you got here. Selling all right, is it?"
Oh, okay. He's a cheater and possibly abusive, but he sounds cute.
Okay. So some redemption for him. Okay. Yeah. Now.
Okay. Yeah.
It's not like Helen is frugal, though, during their marriage. Like, she has a fleet of cars, and I have to list them because I love every single one of them.
You are a car person.
Yes. It's a dark lavender Rolls-Royce convertible, pink Cadillac convertible, white and coral Cadillac sedan, a fire engine red Cadillac convertible, and a white over pink Lincoln Continental.
Okay. So you get to pick one to keep. Which one are you keeping?
I mean, I love... The Rolls Royce is in a dark lavender.
So you're going with the lavender?
Yeah, I mean, I know you're not supposed to pick cars on colors, but, like, please, that would be my choice.
Okay.
She also bought furs and jewelry, but she also worried about her family. She built her brother a brick ranch that had the only swimming pool in his small town. She built her dad a place on Tappan Lake where he lived until he died. And she also built a house next door to her dad's for this couple, Maybelle and Charles Thomas, because they had helped care for her dad when he was dying.
Hmm.
Yeah. Now, because Frank is so much older than Helen, it's not surprising that he dies first. He passes away in 1970 at the age of 80, and Helen travels to Vermont personally to pick out the marble that will be used on the portico he's buried under in Unionport Cemetery, which, by the way, took 4 years and $500,000 to complete.
Wow.
Yeah. It is something. I encourage.
Then.
Like how. Yeah, it's a lot.
Now. It with is. Inflation, that would be.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a lot.
It is like 1.7 million. Yeah. Now, at the site, she also had her beloved dogs, Sugar and Candy, buried.
We like a good dog story.
Yeah, so she loved her dogs.
I mean, it's sad lot. That they're not alive dogs, but Sugar and Candy.
Yeah, they Candy actually Aris. Lived like really long dog lives. So, yeah. Now, to be honest, it sounds like after Frank's death, Helen is a bit adrift. Like, her close friends really seem to be people she's connected with outside of the wealthy circle, and a lot of them are just like her friends from youth. So to them, Helen is like a kind and compassionate woman. Like, her friend Margareta, who's knew her for 49 years, said people said she would change with all the money, but she never did. When she'd come down, we'd sit up all night talking, just like at a pajama party. And then, like, Maybelle, the woman who cared for Helen's father before he died, she said that when Helen came out to Tappan Lake House, she'd wander over in her pajamas and slippers in the morning, and they'd have, like, coffee together. Or they'd share popcorn at night.
So Helen's just a really nice person.
Yeah. But, like, on the other hand, like, her wealthier neighbors in Glenview, like, she was kind of cold and antisocial.
This story is just, like, we're having, like, this, like, seesaw effect where every time I'm, like, oh, I don't like this. Maybe I do. I like this. Yeah, maybe this isn't great.
Right.
So wait, she's what?
So to these wealthy neighbors in her, like, Glenview area, like, she is pretty antisocial. Like, not a lot of people know her very well. Like, one of her neighbors said she wasn't particularly neighborly, but she was pleasant. Like, there's a delivery man in town who thought she was terrific. Like, it's like the delivery man thought she was terrific. She used to give him gifts from time to time, and she used to come over here. Sometimes she'd say, I know I should be more neighborly, but I don't seem to have the time.
Hmm.
And that is because, like, Helen actually is really busy. She had thrown herself into animal activism. And while some of that was, yes, like, financially through donations, a lot of it was actually using her wealth in some very, like, very, very grassrootsy kind of way. Like, she'd heard the dog warden and kennel owner of this town were taking dogs out of the shelter and then selling them to scientific research. She actually hired a private investigator to follow them around, and then she filed a lawsuit against them and, like, put the kennel owner out of business.
And so all of this was true, though?
Like, yeah.
It was? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So she was like, I will solve this case.
Done.
I will save the dogs, right? She was also busy traveling to Florida, where she had started to winter, and also investing in racehorses. And, like, she definitely did not see her animal activism in opposition to, like, racehorse.
More of this, like,
owning.
Story being at odds thing.
Yeah. I mean, like, she thought, like, I mean, because I think our understanding of the racehorse industry now is, like, changing a little bit. But at the time, like, she thought, like, she was doing good in saying, like, essentially, like, oh, the horses will never be, like, whipped, even, like, on the going towards the finish, right?
Okay.
Like, so she had these, like, protocols. But, like, she definitely did not see them at odds with one another. Nor did she see, like, she owned furs.
Okay. Right? So it's just, yeah.
Yeah. Now, in 1975, Helen meets Richard Bailey at a car wash. He is a horse stable owner who is 17 years younger than her. And though his intentions towards her seem to be romantic, I'm not sure how on board she is. He starts bringing her to restaurants, and they go on trips together, but when he asks her to marry him, she turns him down. She later tells a friend, like, she doesn't want to marry a man with less money than her.
Mm-hmm.
And she does say, though, he's, like, an excellent dancer, and he knows all the places to go. So, pro for him. But, like, in addition to their semi-romantic relationship, it's Bailey, through Bailey, like, she purchases 3 horses for about $300,000. Now, on New Year's Eve, they usher in 1977 together at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City, watching Guy Lombardo. And while Richard heads home to New York City, Helen stays in the city a bit longer before heading back to Illinois, and then she goes and spends some time in Tappan Lake. But by February, she has an appointment to keep at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Now, she's generally in good health, but Helen wanted a checkup at the Mayo Clinic because she'd had some health concerns. She was worried about her cholesterol levels. She had some swelling in her ankles. She had a persistent cough, though she wasn't a smoker. And she had a small spot on her lower lip that she was convinced, like, might be cancer.
I can relate.
I thought that actually might make you feel some fuzzies towards.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Now, like, she stayed in Rochester for a few days, but she didn't get the answer she expected. Like, her doctors told her she was in good health and that their primary concern was that she should lose some weight. And then, I mean, this woman is 5'10 and 140 pounds. So I have some thoughts about their advice on this.
Yeah. I hope she didn't try to lose weight.
Well, I mean, Helen doesn't have much time left. We're in the...
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I always forget
that something like...
That something's going to happen.
Yeah, because you're caught up in hearing about Helen.
Yeah, not very smart on my part, considering what we do here.
Yeah, and it never ends up well.
No. Here.
Okay, now...
Oh, okay.
Okay, but Helen... So she's gotten this advice from the doctors, but she's also a bit miffed because she calls a friend and says, like, hey, like, I'm actually not feeling well.
Oh.
So, like, why would they say I'm fine? And she's, like, convinced that they're, like, wrong about it, which, you know, I don't know what was going on with Helen, but could be true given how.
How old is she?
She's 66.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you think how often, like, women's health concerns are kind of, like...
Right. I mean, I was going to ask if she was going through menopause, because everybody's always like, you're healthy. And you're like, no, but I feel like I'm dying.
Right.
And so I didn't know if she was still at that age, but no, she's beyond that.
You know, so, likely, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, there are so many things with women where we actually, like, are convinced we're going to die, and somebody's like, nope.
Yeah.
This is normal.
Mm-hmm. Now.
Yeah.
But, so she definitely expresses to a friend, like, that, like,
not, I think not something's normal. Up,
right?
Yeah.
Now, on February 17th, she's preparing to return home to her Glenview home, and she stops into a specialty shop near the Mayo Clinic, and she purchases a bathroom set that includes an alabaster soap dish and powder box. The total came to $41, which she placed on her Bank AmeriCard, and then she asked the shop attendant to have it sent to her new Fort Lauderdale address, since she just purchased a new condo on the intercoastal waterway down there. So the shop attendant, Phyllis Redelin, will be the last person to have definitively seen Helen Brock.
And that was on the 17th?
Yes.
February 17th. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, a few days later, on February 20th, Belton Morris, who's an animal rights activist who is part of an animal welfare nonprofit. In fact, he's one of the founders. He called Ellen's home in Glenview. He's spoken to her the night before she was supposed to leave, like, the Mayo Clinic area, and they'd agreed that he'd call her over the weekend to discuss a donation she was planning to make to his organization, which was the Animal Protection Institute. No one answered. He called again 4 days later.
Okay.
This time he speaks to a man named Jack Matlick, who is the central figure, or a central figure, in Helen's life and story. Now, Jack, here's some background. He used to deliver dry cleaning to Frank. And Frank liked him so much that he hired him as sort of a groundsman, like, all-purpose houseman kind of guy. And Jack lived rent-free with his wife and 3 children at one of the farm properties that the Brocks owned. And this arrangement continued after Frank died. Now, in many ways, Jack was a fixture in Helen's life. So when Belton talks to Jack, Jack informs him that Helen is in Florida. But the thing is, no one can get a hold of Helen. Like, she's not particularly social with the neighbors, but she does have regular calls and check-ins with her friends, and they aren't hearing from her. Finally, on March 8th, Belton convinces Jack that something might be wrong and asks that he go to police. And this is when Helen is reported missing by Jack and also her brother Charles. In those initial meetings, what Jack tells police is that on February 17th, he picked Helen up from Chicago O'Hare Airport in his personal Jeep. He takes her back to her home in Glenview, where she stays until February 21st. According to Jack, Helen tells him that she's going to Florida to deal with her new property, meet with a lawyer, go to the salon, and handle a few other things. Jack says that he drove her to the airport, this time in her white over coral Cadillac, And he dropped her off at 6:50 a.m. She was wearing a black jacket, black pants, white blouse, and had with her her tan overnight bag. She said she would contact him about getting the remainder of her luggage to Florida because Helen did not travel light. She was known to travel to Florida with up to 40 pieces of luggage.
Okay, first off, that's a lot of luggage.
That is a lot of luggage.
I am known for packing very lightly. So 40, it just sounds overwhelming. But the way you keep saying Jack says, do we not believe him? You're like, Jack says.
Okay, well, because...
Do we not believe him?
Okay. Now, it's because it's clear that what Jack might be saying might not work out, right?
Like, okay.
Things are kind of start to fall apart pretty quickly when police start, like, looking into some stuff. Now, investigators note that he dropped her off at 6:50 a.m., but the first flight to Florida didn't leave until 9:50 a.m. And while we get to the airport extremely early today, that wasn't the case in 1977. Right?
Okay. Yeah, because now I'm like, yeah, so what's the problem? Yeah,
of course you
would have to be there at least 8 hours in advance.
Okay, definitely for you. It feels like
it. Like, I know. Yeah. No. Yeah. What for me?
Well,
am I like...
I mean, I just feel like you're the person who just...
Wait, are you calling me like... A worrywart? Or are you just saying how extremely efficient and organized I am?
The second one, obviously. Obviously. Now, second, they can't find a ticket for Helen on the flight or any other flights that day.
Okay.
Now, then they find out that Jack has done a laundry list of what I'm going to term suspicious things.
Jack.
One, during this time period, he's hired painters and cleaners to work on two rooms of Helen's house. Two, when he left the airport after dropping her off, he actually took her car and cleaned it and detailed it. Three, after that, he went to Helen's bank and accessed a safe deposit box that had both of their names on it.
Okay, so the third one sounds suspicious. We know she didn't ask for the other things?
We don't know.
We don't know?
Okay.
What if Helen's like, this car smells? Maybe. Get it detailed.
Now, then there's another conflict. Jack says that during the 4 days she was in Illinois, she mostly stayed home except for Sunday when she went out for the day with a man returning at midnight. Jack said he thought the man was Richard Bailey, the horse dating guy.
Mm.
But Bailey had called when Helen was out, confirming that it wasn't him. And so Jack said he didn't know who the man was. The thing is, none of the neighbors recalled seeing her during this time. And while that may not have been unusual in regular circumstances, there's like quite clearly these are not regular circumstances, right? Now, in addition, police say they thought that even though Helen's ticket from Minnesota was used, so the ticket from the Mayo Clinic to Chicago O'Hare was used, no one recalled seeing a tall redhead on the plane or at the airport. Is it possible then that she didn't even arrive back in Illinois at all? So while these questions were swirling, Belton, the animal rights guy, hires a private investigator named Ernest Rizzo. I'm just going to refer to him as Rizzo because...
Because it's more fun?
Yes.
Okay.
It makes me think of the Muppets rat, but anyway. Rizzo is this young 30-something-year-old former police guy who started his own private investigation firm. And he is, to put this kindly, like the quintessential stereotype of a PI. He's the meat in dark corners of bars, illegal wiretapping, 90% swagger kind of guy.
We'll be back in a moment.
Rizzo says that he was hired by Charles, Helen's brother, but when he couldn't keep up with Rizzo's $1,000 a day fee, he's picked up by another wealthy person. We now know this was Belton. And the thing I think hilarious is that later, Belton was like, I wasn't paying $1,000 a day. I paid a $300 flat fee. So like Rizzo's going around saying, I'm being paid $1,000 a day. But
no. He's getting $300.
I was in like the newspaper.
Is that the 90% swagger?
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, Rizzo is digging around in the case and tells everyone who will listen to just back off Jack, that Jack had nothing to do with this and that Helen is just a wealthy woman with minimal supervision, just going and doing whatever she would like to do. And Rizzo says there's absolutely no evidence, zero, that there's any foul play involved. If she had been hit on the head or robbed, her body would have surfaced by now. It's not a kidnapping because it's been 31 days now without a ransom demand. Now, Rizzo's first theory is that someone had overheard Helen in New York City talking about getting plastic surgery. Apparently, it was fashionable to get work done by a doctor in Rio de Janeiro. And Rizzo's like, hey, she's likely recovering in peace, and the reason Jack seems so awkward and things don't add up is because he's trying to cover for her.
Hmm. Was there an appointment made?
Well, okay, so the doctor is on vacation.
Okay.
No one can get a hold of him, but when he comes back, he says no, she's not his patient.
Okay.
Rizzo's next theory is that she's taken a cruise with a married couple she knew and that all they would need to do is wait until April 1st when the boat docked in Mexico to check up on that. Now, thankfully, the couple's daughter had actually spoken to them earlier and was able to confirm that they were alone on this trip.
Hmm.
On March 30th, though, the case against Jack grows. In Helen's mail are 11 checks of varying amounts. Jack was the beneficiary of 7 of these. These include a Christmas bonus, his regular salary, money to pay back expenses on the property, money to pay off his loan on his personal Jeep, and money to repurchase a car that Frank had given Jack years ago, but then Jack had sold. And when these checks are sent to graphologists employed by the bank, as well as experts at the state crime lab, it's clear that these checks are not in Helen's handwriting. They appear to come from 2 different people.
Okay, so Jack doesn't seem great, but we keep using his name.
Just listen to the story. Now.
Okay, I'll listen to the story.
Okay. Now, okay. Jack has an answer for why the writing is different. He said that when Helen was home on those 4 days, when she was putting away linens in a trunk, when the lid fell on her hand, injuring it, and he said she'd had to use her other hand to authorize the checks, which would somewhat check out, but like the graphologists are saying, like, those are done in 2 different handwritings.
Mm.
Now, at this point, Rizzo starts slowly moving away from defending Jack, too. He says he's learned that Jack had called around to a bunch of stores trying to purchase a large meat grinder that he eventually had delivered to Helen's house.
Mm-hmm.
Rizzo said that there are 3 very hungry and aggressive German shepherds on the property.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, what he's implying here is that Jack had ground up Helen's body and fed her to her dogs.
So this entire time he's been defending Jack.
Yes.
But now he thinks Jack's done this, like, we're going completely in the opposite end and doing the most horrible thing.
Right. I mean, it's quite a change.
Yeah, it's quite a change. We went from, like, yeah, he's cool, to, no, he ground her up and fed her to some dogs.
Yeah. Now, all of Rizzo's commentary like this puts him in opposition with the police and others. Like, the police start warning potential witnesses not to speak to Rizzo and have to publicly state that no human tissue was found in the grinder, right? And a friend says that these dogs are not aggressive German shepherds. They're like mutts that would pee on the floor if you looked at them wrong. And I mean true, apparently one is part Chihuahua and their names are Lovey, Tinkerbell, and Beauty.
That's very cute. But also, are you like hating on the Chihuahuas?
Look, has your dog ever nervously peed on the floor?
No.
No.
He's only half Chihuahua.
Okay.
We didn't get that half. He does not nervously pee on the floor, but he does. He is a very nervous boy, though, so I can't defend him on that. He shakes in car rides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, obviously, like, I have seen some, like, very large, scary-looking dogs with kind of ironic names. But,
right.
Like, Helen's not that lady. She just has these little tiny unscary dogs. Now, in adding to the layers of suspicion, friends said that Helen kept a daily diary, and police very much wanted access to these in case it contained information that would help locate Helen, but they were nowhere to be found. That is until it came out that Jack had burned the diaries along with her automatic writings.
What's an automatic writing?
Okay. Let me back up here.
Like a diary? What is this?
What is it?
Okay. What is it?
So, like, first, after Frank's death, Helen got really into, like, mediums and all kinds of, like, spiritualist practices. Like, for instance, she had a card reader in Florida who she called every day. And I know you were about to ask.
Like tarot cards?
Like playing cards. Like telling fortunes with playing cards.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Now, like, I know you're about to ask this, but the card reader, Frida, says the last day she heard from Helen was on the 16th.
Okay.
And one of her last fortunes was an ominous one that Frida warned her to stay away from men under 50. And Helen kind of laughed and said not to worry. She was seeing a man over 50. Anyway, okay. Back to the automatic writings. Like, basically, okay. Helen would kind of meditate and channel spirits every morning and, like, write down their messages in a trance. And then she would kind of try to interpret them as needed, as, like, messages from the beyond. And Jack said, hey, like, I was asked to destroy these and her diaries if something happened to her.
Okay. So he's saying he's following her instruction.
Yes. Okay.
But this feels like helpful things.
It does feel like helpful things. Now, a lot of what happens next, like, surrounds the question of Helen's money, if, like, what happens to it if Helen's not there. And to be clear, no one is exactly certain how much she's worth, but they suspect it's somewhere between 7 and 16 million in those initial guesses. So in some ways, Helen's life kind of plugs along without her. Like, her trainer is keeping her horses racing in Florida. So you actually can see all these race results reporting in, like, the months and the years after she disappears. And Jack is still living on her property and caring for her home. Her friend Maybelle is still cleaning her house in Tappan Lake and arranging roses and vases like Helen would. And, like, a cleaning service is handling her condo in Florida.
So it's like Helen's life is happening.
Yeah.
Without her there.
Like, everyone's still kind of making sure it's still running, right? But under the surface, there are conflicts that are arising. For one, there's a squabble over her will, with some saying it should be read, and her lawyer saying, heck no, Helen is not dead. We're not reading her will. He says, like, it's a matter of privacy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Belton, the animal rights guy, is in a quandary because he's built his nonprofit budget around Helen's donations, and suddenly she's not there to donate the money. On the investigative side, everything has stalled out. It's become clearer and clearer as time passes that something has happened to Helen. Like, even the private investigator Rizzo changes his tune and starts saying she must be dead and buried within a certain distance of Chicago O'Hare Airport. But really, any evidence about where she is and what might have happened seems to be escaping just about everyone.
Yeah, because are we going on, like, years at this point?
So, yeah, so it's like we are moving further and further out, right? Like, time is just passing, right? So as time passes, some things happen, and this is not in chronological order. One, the people in charge of her estate fire Jack, and they say it's not because they suspect him of anything, but...
Okay.
Two, some of her associates start pushing for her to be declared legally dead so that access can be granted to her money.
Mm.
But a judge says, like, they have to wait the full 7 years. So,
no. Is that, like, a thing?
Yeah.
7 years?
Seven years. She can be declared dead, and then people can read her will and access it, right? And three, a grand jury is called to review the evidence assembled in the case. Like, so a grand jury will look at, like, all the information presented and decide what's going to happen, right? They ultimately don't pursue any charges against anyone, and the proceedings are kind of kept quiet. Finally, in 1984, 7 years after her disappearance, Helen is legally declared dead. I feel like, Vanessa, at this point, you're like, wait, we have a lot more show to go, right?
I think we do, but...
Mm-hmm. But yeah. Okay. So she is declared dead. And her death date and the date she went missing is officially listed as February 17th, the date the shop worker saw her.
Okay.
The judge says there's not enough evidence to prove she was alive after that date.
I think we agree with that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, finally, in 1984, 7 years after her disappearance, when her will is finally read, Helen has left a relatively small amount of what is believed to be a $21 million fortune to her brother. So to put this into perspective, $21 million is worth something like 70-ish million today.
That's a lot.
Yes. And her brother gets $500,000 in a trust, so that's like $1.5 million. And he's to receive $30,000 a year, which is roughly like $92,000 in today's money.
Hmm.
Jack is actually paid $50,000. And then the rest of the money goes to the Helen Brock Foundation, which she started several years before her disappearance. The goal of the foundation was to aid various nonprofits and causes, and one of their focuses was on animal welfare initiatives. In fact, there are many things that are now named after Helen Brock, like a primate house at the Lincoln Zoo, a humane society. There are big things, there are small things. They still give out grants today. In 1988, though, police finally got their lead. Now, to recap what we covered in our episode on Patricia Blau, Ann Miller, and Rainey Brewer, a man named Silas Jane was in prison for the murder of his brother.
Mm-hmm. So that was from the episode that had, like, all the bizarro horse stuff.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Now, basically, Silas Jane doesn't like his brother because, like, basically they're both in the horse industry and they hate each other, right? In Silas's early attempts to kill his brother, he'd had a bomb placed under the hood of his brother's car, and a young woman named Cheryl Lynn Rood used that car instead, and when she got in, the bomb exploded, killing her.
Mm-hmm.
One of the suspicions in the disappearance of Patricia, Ann, and Renee is that at least one of them may have witnessed the bomb being placed and they were done away with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a theory. Now, a man who shared a prison cell with Silas says that he was hired by Silas to take Helen's remains from a burial site near Minneapolis and relocate them. Police followed up on this, but they're, like, just unable to find this burial site. Okay, now, so Vanessa.
Okay.
I have actually done something in this episode that I never do.
Right.
And that is that I did say the person responsible for Helen's disappearance, their name, in this episode.
You said their name in this episode.
I did.
And it's not Jack.
Well, I don't know, Vanessa, because the question at this moment is, who do you think it is?
Her brother.
Her brother?
Is it?
No. No, he's just...
He's just her brother?
He's just her brother. Why do you think her brother did something?
I don't know, because he got the most money out of this.
Oh, that he is, like, financially motivated.
Yeah, maybe.
Hmm.
But I don't know. I mean, is it Jack? Is it Rizzo?
It's Rizzo. Okay.
No, it's not.
No.
Okay, give me a minute. It's not the horse guy, is it?
It's the horse guy.
It's the horse guy?
Well, one of the horse guys.
The younger one she's dating?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why did we say his name then?
Because okay, here's why I said his name. Because I knew who was responsible. And so as I was reading through all of the research on Helen, like, what ended up happening to me is, like, I see a very quick interview with him early on, which basically he refuses to, like, talk to reporters, right? And then, like, subsequently, as I was reading more and more about, like, the search for Helen, I got kind of fixated, like, looking for him.
So if it was that guy, if it's the horse guy, why is Jack being so weird?
Jack's just weird, to be honest.
So Jack's weirdness was unmotivated.
I think he's just...
So I wasn't supposed to be worried about him getting the car detailed or any of that other stuff you threw in there to confuse me.
Or that's how it confused everyone at the time.
Okay.
Okay. Now, since we now know it's that guy, we're just going to refer to him as R. In 1989, federal authorities open up a case focusing on Helen's disappearance and the potential for R's involvement. It's clear that R had swindled Helen on the purchase of those $300,000 horses. They were not fit, and Helen had actually had to completely retire one of them to her farm right after purchase.
Mm, okay.
Now, R had a history of conning rich older women. He'd first done this through some sort of, like, driving school scheme that he'd run, but then he learned he could easily do it through the horse sales. And so for many of the women, he'd romance them first.
Okay. So I thought he just kind of might have, like, a thing for rich older women when we talked about him before. We talked about him kind of briefly.
Yeah.
Also, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what hadn't been revealed to the public is that during that grand jury trial, which happened in 1979, a Glenview police officer had said during this that he found a spray-painted message in front of Helen's home in Glenview in 1978, the year after she disappeared. The message read, "R knows where Mrs. Brock's body is. Stop him, please."
Hmm. Who wrote the message?
We don't know.
Okay.
But a similar message was found outside one of R's stable.
The stable is just like, what the heck?
Yeah.
It's a gathering place for
it's very crimey
people.
Yeah. Now, okay. So I think people basically know what they're getting into when they get into our podcast. It's very clearly going to involve like violence towards women most often, not always, but you know. But I also know that there are people who are more, not more squeamish, but
are you about to tell us?
They're unprepared to hear about like animal violence and abuse. So that is forthcoming. Now, given the combination of what they now know about our scheming and his history and the horses, this seems like a pretty promising lead to like follow, right? Mm-hmm. But what actually happens is that agents stumble across a different crime entirely while trying to figure out what happened to Helen. In 1991, they're investigating R when they learn of a planned horse killing in Florida.
Is that a thing?
Yes. Now, the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services follows up on this, and they have found a man named Tommy and put him under surveillance. Now, Tommy's known as the Sandman around the barns because he can put a horse to sleep.
Wait, what are we doing? Are we killing winning racehorses so that ours can win?
No.
Why are we killing horses?
Okay. So these horses are insured for money.
We're killing them for insurance money?
Yes.
Ew.
Yes. Now.
So slurpy. Also, you need to clean up my guesses. You can keep some of them in there, but not where I'm like, there's like this big bar at the end that's like, don't scroll past. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, okay.
Now. Okay. So basically what happens or happened is like these are horses that are worth more dead than they are alive. Like
highly insured losing horses?
Yeah, they're not winning.
So they're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Tommy's favorite method is electrocution.
He has a favorite method?
Yeah, because apparently, according to the articles that I read about this, that it's hard to tell the cause of death when electrocution is involved. Sometimes it's believed to be or attributed to colic, right? Now, there's
God, the horse stuff is always like, oh my God. Okay, yeah. Anyway. Okay. Just, now, yeah.
So he is set to off a horse named Streetwise.
Off a horse? Amy.
He's like literally a horse hitman. Like, there's hitmen for horses. Okay, so like this is a show jumper and it's owned by a woman named Donna Brown, but Donna doesn't want to use electrocution on her horse.
Okay.
So Tommy subcontracts out the hit to another man.
Okay.
So not only are there horse hitmen, there are horse hitmen subcontractors.
Wow.
Okay. Now, Tommy is being followed. Of course, he doesn't know this, but agents witness Tommy holding Streetwise's lead as the other man takes a crowbar to one of Streetwise's hind legs.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
What are we going to do that for?
Okay. So Streetwise has a history of colic, and he was uninsurable for colic.
So we're just going to break his leg?
So he had to die. No, he didn't have to die.
Wow.
The horse hitman.
I did not mean to laugh. This is nervous laughter, guys.
No. The horse hitman would have to use a different method in order to get the insurance payout. So.
Can you. So what, they're just going to hit him in the leg and,
so they're and breaking
let him
his,
die?
Well, they're breaking his leg. And then what happens is they call a vet. The vet comes out and is like, oh, my God, what happened? They're like, we're not sure. He, like, stepped wrong. Right.
And then they put him down?
Yeah. I mean, I actually read.
And how's that better than electrocution?
Well, because the horse, if it had died by electrocution, there would have been, like, they wouldn't have known it was electrocution. And it would have been possible for it to be attributed to colic. But they wouldn't have gotten the insurance payout for colic. Because the horse had a history of colic and wasn't insured by for a death by colic. Oh, my God.
So I was just thinking that this Donna person was trying to be nice to the horse.
Oh, no.
And this is way worse.
No. Donna ordered the hit on this horse.
Okay. That was just a gentle hit. Is there such a thing?
No.
No.
No. Now, like, oh my God, like reading an article like from one of the agents who had like witnessed this, like, oh God, they're like, they were still torn up years later about like being unable to save Streetwise. Like they were just too far away.
Okay.
Okay. Now, so Streetwise is put down and his death leads to several other arrests where agents learned that as many as 20 horses have been killed in the USA, like as a way to collect insurance money. And 23 people are arrested. Like, it's during questioning for this that one of the individuals reveals that he has information on Helen. He says that R tried to hire him to kill Helen, but he'd refused. And exactly why would Helen be a target in the first place? Well, like, essentially...
Wait, the horse hitman was hired to kill Helen?
R tried to hire...
The horse hitman.
One of the horse
people. So do we people dapple in humans, too?
Yeah, I guess. And so the person was like, pass.
But I'm okay. Good for that horse murderer to not murder the lady.
Right. Now, the reason Helen was targeted was like essentially the way things were working. R had been using his trainers and a vet who would help him claim the horses he sold were in good condition and could be raced or shown. And when someone like Helen bought the horse, R would pocket the money and then give kickbacks to his accomplices. It's believed that after learning of the condition of at least one of the horses that Helen became aware of the con. So essentially, Helen began asking too many questions. Now, based on all of this, R is arrested and he faced a 28-count indictment, most related to horse cons. And he pled guilty to 16 counts of racketeering, conspiracy, mail and wire fraud, money laundering, but he denied involvement in Helen's disappearance or death. So essentially, he goes to prison for conning Helen, but not for involvement in her death.
But we know.
Right. So this gets even more gruesome. Now,
seriously?
In 2005, another man comes forward. He is an informant for the ATF, and he has some protections for the information he provided. His name is Joe. Joe says that he was friends with a man named Kenneth, and Kenneth was an associate of both R and Silas, that guy who kept trying to kill his brother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kenneth called Joe one night in 1977 and asked him to report to Kenneth's stables. Joe did. It was like a don't ask questions kind of situation. He says he waited out in the dark with Kenneth that night and that Kenneth's brother Kurt pulled up to the Tinley Park stables in a Cadillac. He parked it near a station wagon and then popped the trunk. Inside was a body wrapped in a blanket. Joe said his understanding was it was the Candy Lady, as the men in the horse circuit called her. He claims her face was purple and that she'd been beaten elsewhere. He said that he was told to move her body from the Cadillac to the station wagon with Kenneth, but when they picked her up, Kenneth heard a moan and dropped her in the dirt in the riding ring. Joe says then, Kurt, who was carrying a gun, turned it on Joe and told him to shoot her. And Joe did. Joe says that he believes she was dead at this point and that he was not responsible for killing her. Joe then says that he was in the car as they drove to a steel mill with large smoke houses off of I-65, and that's where her body was incinerated. There's nothing to corroborate this story, but agents say there is a ring of truth to these statements, and Joe did not provide enough information for charges to move forward. In 1995, though, Kenneth faced his own trial. Like in our episode on Patricia, Anne, and Renee, I mentioned a murder of three teenage boys in a stable in 1955.
That's right.
Yep. And it was a crime initially thought to be committed by Silas. Instead, investigators later learned it was Kenneth who killed all three.
Wow, there is just like so much bad stuff happening here. I had forgotten about the teenage boys until you just said that, which is horrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so like, Silas is a murderer. Kenneth is a murderer. R is a murderer. Kurt is helping. Joe is helping.
Like, yeah. Horses are dying.
Horses are being killed left and right. Mm-hmm. Women are dying. Teenage boys are dead.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, last year, R died in prison. And a former federal prosecutor, Ron Safer, said, I've prosecuted hundreds of people who have committed thousands of evil deeds, but only a handful of those people did I regard as truly evil people. R is first in line.
He preyed upon women when they were at their most vulnerable after they lost a loved one or they had been divorced.
Now we are going to listen to Amy's poem, Rush, about Helen Brock, 65, missing since February 17th, 1977, from Rochester, Minnesota. Last night we watched the sky turn bubblegum pink, the horizon lemon drop yellow, just before the sun faded from view. I've chased you across thousands of skies, for years without knowing. Every time I sat in a dark theater, holding the damp palm of a boy I did not love, the hard pull of candy between my teeth, I should have thought of you. Losing you between those gaps of time is just another way to say missing. Helen, I can still watch the sons of your horses pull their way down the track. Flecks of sweat foaming down their backs, but the forgetting will still be there. We all tumble into it, not remembering how, on one wild pink dawn, you stepped onto the tarmac in Miami and tried to claim the life you dreamed of as though it were as easy as slipping a lollipop between your lips.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy. Moro Casino.
America's social casino. Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus. Moto Casino.
America's social casino. Download the Moto Casino app today.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.